Welcome to Unorthodox's long-awaited superstitions episode. There might be cursing, and there will definitely be curses, so proceed with caution. This has been your obscenity warning.
If you step over someone, you will break their life in half. Do not sit at the corner of a table, because no one will marry you.
I'm sure you got plenty of calls about parents who said not to leave an umbrella open indoors because it would rain on your wedding day.
Do not wear your clothes inside out because you'll get beaten up.
I had an Israeli boyfriend and he thought it was bad luck to walk around with just one shoe on.
Do not wear only one shoe or a parent will die.
Whenever my mother would sew something on me while I was wearing the garment, she asked me to chew. It could be gum, a piece of thread, or just pretend I was chewing on something, like, so my brains would not be sewn up.
Do not say goodbye or shake hands over the threshold of, the doorway of a house.
A friend of mine told me that her grandfather, who was originally from Russia, had a very complicated process for warding off the evil eye. He would say, no kanahoras, poo, poo, poo. He would pull down one eyelid a little by pulling down on his cheek. He would spin three times around in a circle, and he would spit. And apparently this was a fake spit, not a real spit, because that would be disgusting.
Never, ever whistle in the house, as this will make all the money blow out.
This is Unorthodox, the world's leading Jewish podcast, and you just heard a little taste of all the responses that you called in when we asked about your family's superstitions. I am Mark Oppenheimer, here as ever with my co-hosts Liel Leibowitz.
Tfu, tfu, tfu.
And Stephanie Butnick.
Patooey, patooey.
So I know that thing only from the old Coffee Talk skit on Saturday Night Live. Like, I didn't know. You've heard people go patooey, patooey.
Oh, my God. Like, every day growing up.
So anyway, there was a lot of superstitions. People called in. They wrote in. There were all these ones we'd never heard of. Here's the thing. Like, I will just come entirely clean about my family and superstitions and say that, honestly, I don't think we had any. Okay, so I want to hear about how you guys grew up, because the three of us all grew up in, you know, different Jewish circumstances. Liel Leibowitz.
Oh my.
You, like, mocked me with your eyes when I said, but Jews don't do superstition. Like,
that's
correct. You grew up in
didn't know that Jews did anything but superstition until I was, like, 23. I was like, oh, there's a religious component to it?
Okay,
it's not just throwing salt in the corner of a room? That's
like,
nice.
Like, just give us, like, what did you grow up with? What was in the air when you were growing up?
So there were two stages, really, to my superstitious education. The first is growing up with my mother. Who never met a superstition she didn't immediately adopt and then improved upon. A small selection would be upturned shoes are an affront to God, doors left open are portals to other dimensions and demons may come, books left open tempt the demons to steal the knowledge and then use it against you. There's a whole host, part of which, you know, the book stuff, for example, is straight out of the Talmud.
Right.
You know,
right.
But part of which is really just crazy. Like, the shoe part is crazy. So
wait, what do you mean upturned shoes? Like,
if the shoes are turned upside down.
Oh, meaning you should not be looking at the soles of them.
Never. So then you go to the army and you think you're done with all this, you know, judgment, and now you could be a tough, no nonsense type of guy. And then you realize that because the army is a bunch of young people who realize very early on that literally you could die tomorrow for no reason that you could control, and it's all luck of the draw, you realize the army is the world's most superstitious place. You never take your picture before you go on duty.
So it's not like a first day of school picture where, like,
because if you take your picture, you're basically saying, you know,
like,
last
was,
will and testament.
This is the picture you use when I die.
I know where this comes from, when there was like a camera and everyone had to, like, the guy had to go under the thing and it was their whole family. But it's like, we live in the era of selfies. And I almost think that, like, it's interesting to see the way that some superstitions have continued to sort of pervade our culture. And they make no sense as we get into this, like, greater and greater technological eras.
Right, but death makes no sense. You know, how do you come to terms with that?
Well, you're going to play the D card?
Yeah, you cling on to these ridiculous things. And like, oh yeah, no, I'm not going to die today because I didn't take a selfie.
Well,
it's
all right.
Fact.
Madame Rationalist Stephanie Butnick, what about you? Do you have superstitions?
So I didn't really grow up with superstitions. However, I'm a very anxious person. My superstitions were not Jewish. They were like, if I count to three on this foot and then I don't walk over the crack, and if I count every single line on the side of the, like, of the middle of the road, then I, and if I land on the left side.
Did you make these up yourself?
So basically, as my therapist explains, like, superstitious behavior is basically, like, a lot of it is intrusive thoughts. It's anxiety.
It's OCD.
It's OCD, basically. Right. It's like a low grade, you know, like the entry level obsessive behavior. And think about it. It makes perfect sense. So I've actually tried, in my effort to be a less anxious person, to rid myself of this, like, if the third car stops, if the third car comes and I get this taxi or I get into that, like, that actually is not helpful thinking for me. And so I'm curious about the ways in which Jews actually, this is bred of anxiety and a sense of trying to have some control in the shtetls, in these, like, in the pogrom era, to have some control over just a world that makes no sense.
Stephanie, I'm not buying this at all. I'll tell you why. I actually think this is, like, one of the terrible things that modernity had done. Because, like, you read the Talmud and there are literally demons everywhere. These very, very wise rabbis who, you know, forged our religion for us literally had these ridiculous beliefs that, like, if you wanted to see the demons, you found the young cat who is born of the older cat and, like, took its placenta and, like, cooked it and put it in your eye and then you could see the demons. So we used to believe in that. And then we took these amazing concepts, this amazing world in which you literally did battle with the Sitra Achra, you know, with the other side, with darkness. And then we said, oh, no, it's not that. It's just anxiety. I'm sorry. No, you're right to skip the cracks. That's where the demons are. And it's a much more interesting world where you actually believe in this, as I did.
And so you think that, have we lost it?
Yeah.
We need a more demon-haunted, enchanted world.
What happens if your kids take their shoes off in your apartment and the feet?
Oh, they know better.
They wouldn't dare.
So we've done it. So you're like, oh, my mom was so crazy, blah, blah, blah. You do it too.
Oh, I'm not saying my mom was so crazy. My mom was right to raise me.
She's 100% correct. I will do everything she says.
Wait. So Lily and Hudson are being raised with, you are passing on your superstitions to them.
100%.
And you hope that they will pass it. Like, God willing, it gives you many grandchildren.
When we don't even wear shoes anymore. Because robots walk they would for us. Fight they have to the stay demons the right direction.
As I had fought the demons.
I'm so terrified to come to the Upper West Side and visit you next time. It's like, what if I take my shoes off wrong?
They're little Buffy vampire slayers.
So look, when we decided to do this show on Jewish superstitions, one of our producers, Shira Talishkin, went all in. She was all about this particular episode.
And we'll also say, like, it took us a few tries to get this show off the ground. Like, some might say
it was cursed.
A little bit.
A little bit. Shira joins us today. Hello, Shira.
Hey, guys.
So this is an episode you were really excited about and really, really involved in helping put together.
Yeah, I think on the one hand, I'm very, like, grew up with a lot of superstitions and I find them really interesting. One of the things that I think is really interesting is that for a lot of people, and this was true for a lot of our listeners who called in and for people that we've talked to who you're going to hear on the show, they might not keep any aspect of what we think of as traditional Jewish practice, right? So there's people who, like, don't keep kosher, they don't go to synagogue, they, like, don't really care, but, like, they would never have a baby shower. They would not have upturned shoes. Like, they would not name their child after a living parent. And I think when we talk about Jewish practice, we often talk about, like, the spiritual dimensions or the community dimensions. But they don't actually do anything in Judaism, right? So, like, if you're Catholic, there's a lot of stuff that if you do or you don't do, like, you go to hell. Like, that's really bad. Like, you want to be a good Catholic because the ramifications are, like, not amazing. But in Judaism, it's, like, not actually clear what happens to you if you do stuff. And superstitions are this one area of Jewish practice where it's just like, oh my God, like, if I don't do this, like, something bad might happen.
It's one area where you could be controlled.
It's, yeah. and it's like the word is that's used is efficacious. It's like an act that, like, does something in the world. Like, it actually, like, impacts the world. And it's, like, a very direct relationship. And so like that was super interesting to me, and the fact that they're so personal. So like again, like I grew up with tons of like my mom like knocks on the doors of an empty room before she enters to alert the demons. And
wait, every time she enters an empty room?
Yeah, because like they're meeting and you.
And she's going around. Let's say you leave the house and you haven't made your bed, and she's thinking I'll straighten up, and she's about to walk into your room, like knock, knock, knock.
Yeah.
Dozens of times a day, I'm guessing.
Well, I mean, how often do you close all the doors? We live in Manhattan. It's like there's not that many doors.
I do that.
Wow.
What? Leo, you're so learning so a lot.
I'm a total primitive. Straight out of some village in like the 13th century.
I will jump in, Mark, and say like this is what is so interesting is that nobody knows what someone else's family does. It like brings us back to like pre-shtetl times when every village did their own Jewish customs, and it developed and it's passed down family to family.
And the village of Great Neck, they didn't get in the third subway car, apparently.
And, no, like, but like we didn't ride the subway. Right, like,
it's amazing it's what I'm learning about all
like,
of you.
Exactly. And like, but again, like I didn't hear any, like I didn't know about the like chewing a thread thing, which it seems like everyone and their mother did.
Yeah.
And so there's like a really personal aspect of it that like we lost the oral tradition of Jewish like life way back when, but it's like totally survived in these weird things that people do. And like,
So what are some of these traditions? I mean, there's apparently this extraordinary history and there's lots of them in Talmud, which I want to ask you about in a moment, but are there some traditions that we've lost? Like you had mentioned one in weddings that we don't seem to have anymore.
Well, there's a lot that we've like totally lost, but we also don't realize how much of Jewish practice today is actually based on this belief of demons. So people tend to think like, oh, Judaism got this reputation post-Enlightenment for being rational. And like also when like Maimonides became the face of Judaism for a couple like Ashkenazi people.
Fake news.
Fake Jews. To the max. But a lot of our, so what happened there is that a lot of the like demonic superstitious beliefs kind of got stripped away. So like, okay, one good example.
So there were more.
Like, well, just like they were real. So like one good example that a lot of people know is that at weddings, after like the thing that ends the wedding ceremony is the groom will usually like smash a glass. And everyone yells Mazel Tov and whatever. And like, what are some of the reasons you guys have heard for why we do that?
Oh, because you smash the glass into a million pieces and you can't fully put it back together and the universe was shattered.
Right. I've heard that one. I've also heard that it recalls the destruction of the Second Temple and how there's joy even in destruction. The joy can rise from the ashes in a sense.
If you go to a Jewish wedding and the officiant isn't like, well, there are several reasons.
Right.
People
they have so
disagree.
Many.
It's like part of the wedding now so is many. To tell right. people but how many reasons there
the
are.
The reason they're like probably not going to give is, so the way this ritual used to go is he would drink the wine. And then he would drink the cup and then smash it against the wall, right? And so if you go to a lot of synagogues like throughout Europe, there's a special stone on the synagogue wall that
for
is
smashing.
And it usually has like a Star of David and like a pasuk, like a verse from the Bible on it. And it's a stone where you would smash everything. And what it was you were giving wine to the Sitra Acher, to the dark side, so that you were to kind of satiate them and have them not
confuse
attack
them.
The couple. Mm-hmm. So they'd be like, okay.
That's so much better than what we have now. Like, I love the idea that you smash it. It's very romantic. It's like sexy. See?
I also just want to note that even from like kind of the earliest times of Jewish tradition coming together, rabbinic Judaism coming together, a lot of these sort of medicinal beliefs and sort of superstition beliefs were really the domain of Jewish women, were often passed down through mothers and grandmothers. And even today, right, it's kind of like, do you believe in superstitions or did your grandma have any superstitions? People aren't as much like, oh, like your grandpa probably
what did your grandpa
things.
Do?
Yeah.
That's a terrific point. And, you know, Shir Talishkin, we're so glad to be the beneficiary of your weird obsession with superstitions.
You know everything.
Here's the good news, right, is that in this episode that Shir and Josh helped us put together, we realized that these practices, they continue to abound. They aren't as widely embraced and maybe they aren't quite as crazy. But you know what? As you guys made clear, as you and the J Crew made clear by calling into our voicemail superstition hotline, the crazy has not gone out of the Jews. So we are here to take you on a Jewish journey of superstition. We have a number of stops on this weird, accursed train. Shir Talushkin and Josh Cross left the offices, went to the other side of the shtetl, also known as the sidewalk in front of Kosher Marketplace on the Upper West Side, and got some of New Yorkers' favorite superstitions.
Can we ask you, do you have any superstitions in your life, or did your family grow up with any superstitions?
My mom has them. When we go to family functions like weddings, bar mitzvahs, she has Our family wear red somewhere inside our clothing to ward off the evil eye. So before I had my kids, she didn't want me to buy clothing.
Rabbit's foot all the time. In fact, I have a rabbit's foot coming over here. I am a rabbit.
There's you don't whistle backstage. Basically, it comes from the legend that used to the stagehands used to be seamen. And the seamen take their cues by whistles. So if somebody's whistling backstage, they don't know if they're taking the cues from whatever, so it's you don't whistle backstage.
I am the superstition queen, despite an Ivy League education and a graduate degree. When I have new grandchildren, I put red bendelach around everything. Number 13 is on the way, with another red bendel on the way too. And when there's a wedding or something like that, they have to wear a red bendel. And just the other day, I was asking somebody about how to get rid of the ayin hara. Don't walk over somebody, because then they won't grow. If somebody sewed something on us, you had to bite the thread. And my grandmother had a really crazy story about her aunt was very, very sick. And in the shtetl, they actually took an empty coffin with her name on it to the cemetery so that she wouldn't die, and she got better. I told you hit the right person.
If someone goes to Israel and they gives me a red string, I'll wear it, but I don't necessarily, I'm not that into that kind of stuff. Anything that just makes you feel better, makes you feel safe or protected, whatever it is, I think it's just worth doing.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm very superstitious. I don't walk underneath ladders, and I don't like when black cats cross me. You know, all the stuff that we grew up watching, Halloween and all that crazy stuff, you know, you get a little paranoid. But I find that when I stray away from the ladders, I have good luck. If I go underneath a ladder, something tends to happen. Black cat crossed me one time, walked underneath the ladder, same day, car accident.
I'm hedging my bets.
I'm not really that superstitious, but I think it came from my mom being very superstitious but never having reasons for anything. Whenever my nieces and nephews were born, she would always tell us don't show a baby his or her reflection until they have teeth. I don't know the origin of it. I don't know what will happen if you do. How can you be superstitious when you never really knew why?
I never say anything too nice about my kids without saying God willing or bli ayin hara. I don't even think about it. I just go with it and follow all my superstitions to their illogical conclusions.
If you rub your chin against a furry microphone like I'm doing, then there'll be no line in the deli when I get in there. Okay, so my friend, when he goes to watch a football team, my friend Alex Rubin in London, when he goes to watch his favorite football team, Arsenal, if they lose a game, he has a scarf that he's had with him since he was 4 years old, and it has tassels on it. And every time they lose a game, he pulls off one of the tassels. It's almost like a pseudo-religious, yeah, it's really, it's, there's not many left.
Great, well, thank you.
Put a coat on.
That's what I said.
We're fortunate to have more than one in-house superstition maven here at Tablet Magazine. Our editor-in-chief, Alana Newhouse, is in fact a woman deeply in love with superstition.
I will put it like this. You've just heard me and where I come from. Alana is the most superstitious person I know.
Whoa. So we sat down with Alana.
I'm the LeBron of superstition. She's the Michael Jordan.
She's the Michael Jordan.
It's a whole new level.
Is Stephanie the Magic Johnson?
I'm paying Dwayne Wade.
We sat down with Alana Newhouse a few weeks ago, and she took us into the world of superstition, Newhouse style.
We are here with Alana Newhouse. She's the founder and editor of Tablet Magazine. We know her well. We like her a lot. And we are just happy to be here with you, Alana, to talk superstition.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we should say, you're the most superstitious person I know, like by leaps and bounds.
Just means you know the wrong people.
Were superstitions a part of your life when you were growing up? These
yes.
are like, they're sort of a new thing to me, but were you raised with?
Yes. My mother's family is from Ladino-speaking Sephardic Jews, and my father's family is from Yiddish-speaking Ashkenaz Jews. And my mother's side of the family was deeply superstitious. My grandmother, my maternal grandmother, with whom I was close for most of my life, including up until my adult life, was very superstitious.
So share some of these superstitions. What weren't you allowed to do as a kid to not upset the demons?
there are so many things, but the thing that I remember the most was we were never allowed to give knives as a gift, as part of a gift. So when my mother would give wedding gifts, if she gave a challah plate, she would never give the knife along with the challah plate. She would never buy flatware for anyone. And actually, there was some, it even went so far as that there was some way in which we were supposed to set the table where we're supposed to set knives last, and the knives had to be on the table after the brachot. So you had to say Kiddush and do hamotzi over the challah, and then you could put out everyone's knives.
Because the knives will summon warfare and bad feelings.
The idea was that if you gave a gift of a knife, what you were telling someone was that you wanted to have a fight, and that knives represented hostility and conflict. So it was seen as very bad luck, particularly around the idea that you'd have conflict in a family or around a family table was very radioactive. Even though we fought all the time. I don't know how much the knives could have possibly helped us.
So did all that stuff make sense to you? Was it just what your family did, or did you think it was a little nutty?
It made complete sense to me. I mean, it made as much sense to me as anything else, as stopping all work on Friday, as not eating on Yom Kippur and other fast days. I mean, it didn't strike me as any more or less rational than anything else we did.
See, but it's interesting you say that, because you grew up in a religious household. So did you understand that there was some sort of division between religion and superstition?
No,
they're both
the
same.
I did not, yes.
And believing means the demons and halacha, both together.
Yes, and I should be specific that it's not because I was taught superstitions in school, although it was probably bandied about by kids or parents or the parents of other of my friends, but it's an atmospheric, and it was part of our general lives. You know, but it's also kind of interesting because I don't think that I could say that my life could be parsed between what was my religious life and what was my non-religious life. We didn't have those divisions. Your life was your life. So the idea that superstitions weren't distinct inside of religion makes as little sense as superstition, as religion being parsed from secular life.
But I love the word that you use, atmospherics. I mean, in a way, they're that much more powerful. I know growing up, you know, to understand why, you know, God wants us to do one thing or another is one thing, but to say to a kid something like, if you leave a book open, the demons will come and steal all your knowledge, that actually makes weird sense to a child, no?
Yeah, and then, yes, and also, you know, I think that because so much of Jewish practice and Jewish observance involves things that do have their rooting in Jewish law, but if you wanted to, you could see them as having valence from a superstition perspective. For example, wearing a kippah, right? I know what the actual halachic...
Do not upset God by showing him your head. He will strike you down.
Right, exactly. Like, you could certainly see it as being, as something that was related to the idea of superstition or something as less than rational.
But at some point you broke with one, the religious part, and you preserved the other.
No,
the
I broke with both, part. But then I came back to superstition first.
Okay. Why? How? Tell us.
Well, I broke with both because I went to college and started reading other things. And I just, I started engaging more with the outside world. I became very interested in politics and very interested in culture and art and in other religions. And in science and in economics. And I wanted to understand whether there were more simpler explanations for some things. And science offers a bunch of simple explanations that felt at the time for me clearer and more believable. So for me, a bunch of religious practice started to feel oppressive. And so I'd say I started to stray and then wholly abandon a lot of the religious practice that I grew up with. When I did that, the superstition went with it because, again, it wasn't they weren't disconnected. So I didn't see them as separate. But when my life changed later on, what came roaring back was a belief in superstition first.
When is that? Is that when you have a family of your own and you sort of start thinking about the traditions that you want there?
Certain things came back when I was pregnant. Interestingly, when I was pregnant, I went to the supermarket with my stepdaughter, and there was one of those quarter machines, and the quarter machine spit out a red bracelet, a red string bracelet that has a little wooden fish on it. And my stepdaughter looked at me and said, "You should wear it. It'll probably be good luck for the baby." It's not a Kabbalah bracelet because it came from Key Food, right?
But it's a Kabbalah bracelet.
Right. It's a Kabbalah bracelet. Right. But what was interesting was that when she said that, there was a part of me that took heed. I didn't know whether or not she or Key Food was a messenger from something, but I decided that I should wear that bracelet.
Okay, hold on. I want to pause here and play, you know, inside the superstitious person's studio. Take us through this process. So you hear this thing, which is not a thing, right? It's not based in tradition. It's not, you know, a long-held belief. It has no explanation. Someone said something, and then you decide, okay, I'm going to do this. What goes on through your mind?
What if she's right? I mean, I think it's just as simple as that. What if she's right? What if I'm supposed to wear this red string?
And, why take the chance? Why risk
right,
it?
Right. Why risk it?
Why not wear it?
All of a sudden, my brain imagined a world in which that was something I was supposed to hear in that moment. And it would be deeply irresponsible for me to hear it and understand its meaning and ignore it.
Do you think that the idea of why not do these things, do you think that is what sort of undergirds the Jewish, the way we sort of lean on superstition? Like,
well, I don't know. But for me, what's interesting is my relationship to superstition is negative. It's not positive. So I don't perform any acts because I believe that they're going to cause millions of dollars to rain on my head or for me to have a cupcake every single day. I perform to the extent that I adhere to any of this, it's out of a belief that I will avoid harm for me or my loved ones. So for me, it definitely exists in a negative space, not a positive space. I don't think that's how the world works. My sense, and I understand that history doesn't bear this out, but my sense is that it is fair to ask God for protection from harm. I would never be so presumptuous to ask God to get me a yacht or $1 billion. That doesn't feel like what we get to ask of God. And I say that with the absolute understanding that many, many people, many, many good people don't even get protection from God. But somehow of the things to ask for, I think shielding from danger right. And from harm is...
You made me, you keep me.
Right. That somehow feels more legitimate as an ask.
So could you give us a few examples of things you do now that you almost don't even think about doing?
Sure. I mean, you asked me before when it all started, and it definitely did start when I was pregnant. But then my son last year had a seizure, and it was a particularly intense seizure. And when we were in the hospital afterwards, they gave us a medication if he should have another seizure, if it should last a certain amount of time, you're supposed to give him this medication to stop the seizure. And what they explained to us is that actually seizures are fairly common, particularly among small children. And if he were to have another seizure within the next 6 months, it would be a reason to see him as potentially epileptic and then give him epilepsy medication. If he were to not have another seizure within 6 months, then it's considered a one-off. And it's idiopathic. So I carried around this seizure medication with me in my bag at all times for 7 months. At the 7.5 month mark, I woke up that morning and I was looking through my bag and I said, you know what? I don't need this anymore because it's 7.5 months. I not only did I meet the deadline, but I even went past it a little bit. And so I took the seizure medication out of my bag, and that day he had another one. And I know it's nutty, right? But it scared the shit out of me. And I'm sure I'm not going to take that thing out of my bag. I'm sure he's going to be in college, and I'm still going to be walking around with that thing in my bag. And thankfully he's fine, and that second seizure was actually not a big deal at all, and it was very mild, but it...
Knock on wood.
Right, thank God. But it was the kind of thing that once it happened, it made complete sense to me.
So do superstitions have anything to do with God in your mind? Do they have anything to do with that relationship?
Sort of. So in this, I think... It's interesting. I think the best way to answer that is that I have been intellectually and theologically and emotionally very affected by post-Holocaust theological debates. And I was particularly affected by the question of whether or not the covenant with God is still operative. And in this, to the extent that I would recommend anything to anyone else, I would definitely recommend Shaul Magid's read of the Warsaw Ghetto Rabbi and his sermons in the Warsaw Ghetto and his theology. And Shaul has a read of Rabbi Shapiro's work that I think strikes me as psychologically right, according to which he believes that the rabbi, after witnessing truly freakish barbarism, a barbarism and gruesome hatred on par with literally nothing else than anyone in human history could recall, eventually called it what it was. He said it's unparalleled and unprecedented, which in theological terms means it's a break from tradition. So then the question becomes, is the covenant with God still operative? I don't know. And I'm not sure. And I don't know if God speaks to us anymore. And I don't know what our relationship with God is. Here's what I do know. That for hundreds of years, Jews, particularly Jews in Eastern Europe, but Jews all over, had an understanding that there was a universe between them and God. That universe was populated by spirits, messengers, golems, mm-hmm. Dybbuks, and those beings were intermediaries between God and the earth. And those Jews believed that those intermediaries were operative in their lives. I guess what I wonder is, maybe they're still operative in our lives, even and maybe in exchange for God not being operative. So maybe our covenant with God is broken, but we still are able to communicate with God through our behavior.
Is that comforting?
Yes. Certainly more comforting than believing that God just abandoned us and there's no more God.
And that is more or less the premise of Soloveitchik's Lonely Man of Faith, right?
Correct.
Is that we still do this, but we have to do this through community and communion with one another rather than individually, the superstitious way.
Oh, that's funny. I never saw superstition as being lonely.
Don't you think it is?
No. I see it as forging relationships between me and other people. If I make sure that I never give someone a knife.
We will never, ever
fight.
As you never fought with your mother.
Right. Could you imagine? imagine if she had given me a knife.
I was about to say.
I don't see superstitions as being lonely at all. In fact, if you imagine that they're connecting you to a whole population of intermediaries between you and God, whether those things are forms of energy or spirits or dybbuks or other human beings, you're never alone.
Right. But every other, like literally every other commandment or, you know, communal obligation that you have in Judaism has to be performed together with other people, from prayer to, you know, celebrations to anything. Superstition.
Less so for women.
That's true.
Fewer of the female obligations get done communally. So I don't know that I necessarily have that as a model.
So is there anything that you do that if you feel like people found out that they might think was like a little wacky?
Yes, but why would I tell you?
Because I want to know so I can do it.
Okay, fine. So there's one part in the Shulchan Aruch that actually explains the way that you're supposed to put on your shoes. You're supposed to put your right shoe on first and then your left shoe, and then you're supposed to tie your left shoe and then tie your right shoe. And that is how I put on my shoes or boots. And it's also how I put on my son's shoes, which for anybody who's had a toddler knows, you basically just try your best to get their various items on in whatever way you possibly can. And the idea of having a method of clothing them is insane. And yet I did it and still do it all the time.
That was Alana Newhouse sitting down with Liel and Stephanie a few weeks ago and telling us about a very complicated way to put shoes on a toddler.
By the way, it's so intimate to hear these details about someone else's life. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah. You know, I put shoes on a toddler. Put your goddamn shoes on. There are four others of you. We have
like
to get out the door.
You're shoes everywhere to like feet everywhere in your
Pick
house.
Pick two shoes that are hopefully of opposite feet and get them on before, if you want dinner.
Any two shoes.
Any two shoes. What do you mean they're tight? You think they complained about tight shoes in the shtetl?
My grandmother had a superstition that the height that you held the Havdalah candle during Havdalah was how tall your husband was going to be. So whenever we were being sort of lazy and holding it about our waist, she would make sure we lifted our hands up high.
If you're having a piece of clothing tailored, you can't put it on a bed while it's still in progress. The clothing will be put to sleep, meaning it'll take the tailor a long time to finish the project.
Whenever someone lost a button, a seam unraveled, or some mishap that required a needle and thread, she would make them take off the garment before doing a little bit of sewing because, quote, if you sew on yourself, you'll sew up your brains, unquote.
When you're having clothing altered or clothing fitted, my grandmother would always have us hold a string in our mouth.
You're not supposed to step over anybody's legs when you're sitting around in a living room or something because it means that their limbs won't grow properly.
When we're going on a journey, everybody sits for a moment of silence. It's ceremoniously introduced with the word seli, which means we sat, and then the action's completed with the words Stali, we got up.
I just knew I couldn't whistle in the house. And he would extend this to Shabbat and say we weren't allowed to whistle on Shabbat. It was thought that whistling would bring bad luck and threaten your parnasa, your financial welfare.
From one shtetl to another, we asked our roving correspondent, Skylar Inman, host of the excellent podcast Intractable, to go up to Amuka, a gravesite up a windy road up a mountain in northern Israel, to visit the grave of Rabbi Yonatan Ben Uziel, who is believed to posthumously bless people who want to find love.
Right now, we are near... We're pretty close to Amuka.
There's something going on.
The place you just heard me mention, Amuka, is the location of a tiny building with big religious meaning. You see, the gravesite that sits inside the building at Amuka is a popular pilgrimage destination. And according to the lore, single Jewish men and women who pray there will meet their soulmates within the year. Except, there's a catch. Because Amuka is located in the hills of northern Israel, not so far from the border with Lebanon or the Sea of Galilee, and to get there means driving up and down rocky roads, twisting and turning through the Biria forest, just north of the ancient city of Tzfat. And the car I'm in sounds like its engine is just barely up for the job. It's really steep here.
You feel the air pressure?
Yeah, a little bit. The car belongs to Moshe, the driver, who also happens to be my boyfriend's father. Now, how exactly I, a young, non-Jewish woman, found myself hitching a ride from my Israeli boyfriend's father to Israel's number one prayer site for Jewish singles is a slightly longer story. So let's go back to the beginning.
So in Jewish theology, there's a concept that God is everywhere. And so you can pray anywhere. But in Jewish tradition, there's a special extra tacked on to if you go visit a grave.
This is Gila Levitan, a fantastic Australian-Israeli tour guide whom I met in Tel Aviv months ago. Gila leads trips of all kinds through her company, Walkabout Israel, and is this amazing one-woman Wikipedia when it comes to the nooks and crannies of Jewish history here. So naturally, when I got an email from Mark, Stephanie, and Liel a couple of weeks ago asking me to go and check out Amuka and its traditions, Gila was the first person I messaged.
And that really comes from the mystical idea that a tzaddik, which is a righteous person, when they ascend to heaven, they go directly to heaven, whereas us normal people have to be judged for our deeds and see if we're good or bad. And mystically, there's still a little bit of your soul left with your body. So if people go to the graves, then it's like this direct line to God, direct line to heaven.
It's a hotline.
Yeah, exactly. It's a hotline to heaven.
Now, Amuka is far from the only grave that believers go to in order to pray. So I asked Gila, what makes Amuka special? What sets it apart from the other graves? And why is it this place in particular, where so many unmarried people go to pray to meet their soulmate?
The one that's in Amuka is Yonatan Ben Uziel, who was a student of Hillel the Elder, one of these famous rabbis. And they say about him that his teachings were so sweet that all the angels would gather around on top of his head to hear it. And then if a bird flew above it, they'd get burned because you had these angels around him. But he didn't ever marry. And he said before he died that anybody that came to pray at my grave, they'd be blessed with a partner.
And Gila, it turns out, gave it a try or two herself.
I think it was one time I had a friend who was studying in Tzfat, and I went up to her for the weekend, and she told me about this place, Amuka. And so I went there, and I did the whole procedure of what you have to do, and I got a key, or you buy a key, or you give charity money and then they give you a key. And the whole idea is that you're meant to hold on to the key and then you'll get married. And that key broke, so I'm still not married. So it worked for my friend who was studying there, because really? She went there and she's now married. But she had a boyfriend before she was there in the yeshiva. And another friend of mine, when I told her about this and she came to visit me, she wanted to do it because we were in the area on a different trip. And we went and did it. And she's getting married now. But I think I lost my key. So maybe third time's a charm and I need to go there again. I don't know.
With Gila's assurances that it really did work, I did what any good journalist would do. I found a native Hebrew speaker to contact the yeshiva directly in order to inquire about the best day to go visit the gravesite. Naturally, the intermediary I chose was the one I live with, my boyfriend, Yoav.
Shalom.
Eventually, the yeshiva's hold music, which was a romantic adaptation of the Eshet Chayil prayer, sung by Israeli pop sensation Benel Tavori, gave way to a very kind man who told Yoav that the best day to come is on Erev Rosh Chodesh, the day before the new moon, which gave me about 48 hours to get things sorted out. The only problem was, I couldn't find a single driver who wanted to pick me up from Tel Aviv and drive me 3 hours north to a gravesite in the middle of the woods. After a great deal of stressing and complaining on my part, Yoav finally perked up with a solution. He had an idea of someone who might be willing to make the trip with me.
Shalom, shalom.
His dad, Moshe.
There's lots of people. Oh, we have arrived.
The drive up to Amuka is long, more than the 3 hours we had budgeted for it. And on the way, Moshe and I talk about all kinds of things. He's excited because, he says, this visit to the gravesite is almost as foreign for him as it is for me. And by the time we roll up into the parking lot, we're both ready to see what's in store. For all of its fabled mystical powers, Amuka is a pretty simple place. You park at the bottom of a sloped pathway that's divided for women on one side and men on the other. And just as the man from the yeshiva had promised, there was a steady stream of believers coming in already. The building itself, up the hill a little ways, was a small square built from limestone, with a gift shop just outside its front doors, where visitors to the grave could buy all sorts of romantic knickknacks. A key like the one Gila mentioned, a glass that your future husband can break at the wedding, talit, which you can save to give as a gift to your betrothed once you meet him. And it was in that very gift shop that I met Ephraim, whose family has been taking care of the gravesite for the past 30 years.
My name is, call me Ephraim. My mother here, she built this place. She all the time studied Torah and she cleaned the place.
Ephraim gave me the basic rundown of Yonatan ben Uziel. Great guy, fantastic Torah scholar, very much single for his whole life. He tells me all kinds of people come to visit the place because it's just so special. And I ask him if non-Jews come to pray too. He says, not many, but yeah.
And does it work?
Yeah, people get married, healthy, success. When you pray, you not pray to the rabbi. Mm-hmm. Bizkut a rabbi.
So you ask, makes you happen. Ask him to help you,
yeah,
basically.
Help you. Yeah.
So if someone comes here to pray for marriage, what do they need to do?
You want to do this?
Maybe.
Do this for you. I show you the prayer to read. You need to do this and this. You sing it, eh?
Ephraim, who's already in the motion of collecting the things I need in order to complete the ceremony, looks back at me for a second as if he's double-checking for a wedding ring.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm not married.
You go inside the rabbi. You read this one time inside the rabbi.
Okay.
Okay? Give you a candle.
Okay, candle.
Candle, come and show you.
So it
first, inside the rabbi, you read this one time.
Okay.
After you light the candle there, you make a wish for you. That
black thing right there?
Yeah, you make a wish for you, for a sister not here, friend.
Mm-hmm.
After you go on the top, on the roof, you do 7 circles. You see, people, you should go from there.
Yeah.
All circle, you repeat this one time. And you can think about your sister.
And in English, it's okay?
Yeah.
So if I do this for myself, does that mean it's going to happen like this year? Or
3 years.
Wow. Okay. So I have to be careful. Yeah. If I don't want to get married this year, I shouldn't do that.
Why? Not be alone. Not good.
Right. Okay.
I told Ephraim I'd think about it, but that I had to talk to some more people first. So I pocketed the little candles and the match, folding up the sheets of paper he'd given me with the English prayer printed on it. Ephraim, probably assuming I was just being shy, tried to offer me an out as I walked away. You can also think about someone else who wants to get married, he said. Not yourself.
When you do the circle, think about your friend.
Okay, someone.
Someone friend, who needs think this. About them. Say okay. The name.
Yeah, okay.
Michelle Moses, Jimmy.
Throughout the afternoon, people streamed in from near and far. Mothers and fathers praying for their children to meet the one. Like David, a Frenchman who arrived with his 2 marriage-aged sons.
I've got my son studying here. So they've got a week of holidays.
Uh-huh.
So I rent a car and take them to all the tzaddikim, whoever never get married, when he comes and pray here, is to get married in the year.
So are you hoping for that for your son?
Why not? They've got 21. This one is 19.
You hear stories of this happening?
Yeah, a lot of stories, yeah. In the car, my son told me that his friend was here last year, and 2 months later, he's got married.
There was also Masha, a woman who, as she boarded her bus back to Jerusalem, casually dropped the fact that she was visiting the tomb for what you might call professional reasons.
It's a special place to pray. And so there's a lot of things that people need. And I came to Daven for a lot of people. I have a lot going on in my life, but I decided today is a day that I was going to take off and think about others. I think that's my bus going, so
that's
I can't
awesome.
Even say.
Okay. Was it for love specifically today?
Well, this is a fantastic place for praying for a person's soulmate. And I actually happen to be a matchmaker, so I also...
No way.
Yeah.
This is fascinating.
But most people I spoke with were a bit bashful, backing away shyly as I told them what I was doing and insisting that they couldn't possibly have anything interesting to say. One visitor, a middle-aged woman, offered me some advice. You're going to ask a lot of people here if they're praying for their own zivug, and a lot of them are, she told me. But almost everyone will tell you that they're here to pray for someone else's match. But not everyone was shy. There were even success stories. One woman, Miriam, when she overheard me asking someone else if they believed in the tradition, leaned over and said, well, it worked for me.
Basically, I came with my mother and a family friend, and we went and we prayed in the kever, and then we were coming out of the kever, and the guy said, you're here to find your zivug, and I said, yeah. So he said, go take this paper and go up to the dome, there's a dome on top, and walk around 7 times, same as Mola David, and say the Yehi Ratzon. And hopefully by next year you'll be married. So I went up, I went 7 times around and I said it. And then, yeah, we prayed. And as we came down, my friend said, hopefully next year you'll come and you'll say thank you. You'll come back and with your husband, you'll say thank you to Hashem for the gift he gave you. So yeah, I got married August, about less than 2 months ago. Wow. And me and my husband just came from America. We came on a trip to Israel and we said, the one place I want to go is Amuka. So came here.
So how did it feel to pray here when you were still single? Was it something that you like felt like you knew it would work, or was it kind of just something that
I mean
you
it felt wasn't like my you'd... first time here. I'd been here a couple of times before, but we were here last year and on summer vacation, so we stopped by.
Wow. Any idea why it worked the last time?
I don't know if it was this or if it was many other things that we did throughout the trip, but you know, I guess eventually all the prayers add up.
As the afternoon faded into evening and the sun began to dip below the hilltops, I had to confront my options. On the one hand, there was something stubborn within me that almost bristled at the tradition's implications, that people aren't whole until they're married. On the other hand, though, if anything feels apt for divine intervention, it would certainly be love. So I figured, why not? I walked up the stone path to the tomb, and I joined the people praying there. I walked out to the iron structure Ephraim had showed me, and I lit the candles he had given me. Moshe, waiting for me on the stairs with a bemused little smile, walked up to the roof with me and helped me count. 7 times around the blue dome as I circled it. He took a video of me to send to the family WhatsApp as I did it.
You know, if you do it, it means you have to get married this year, Moshe. Yeah. How do you feel about that?
He gave me in Hebrew.
Oh, you have it too.
Yeah. He told me, you look for the book. I told him yes. So he gave me and he explained to me.
And then it was done.
I did everything. I went around it 7 times.
Yeah, you get married based on this.
All right. I'll let you know if it happens.
When you success, you need to say thank you to the rabbi.
So I come back.
Yeah.
Okay.
And who knows? Maybe one day I'll be back.
That was Skylar Inman. Go check out her podcast, Intractable, on iTunes and other free platforms.
If you're with a friend or a family member and you both walk on opposite sides of a pole, a telephone pole or something along those lines, that you'll get angry with them. And the only way to break the curse, essentially, is to say bread and butter.
When my mom was growing up in Newark, New Jersey, her grandmother would tell her, never say goodbye, always say so long. My mom and her siblings didn't think much of it until one day she and her sister were walking down the street and saw a cute little bird. As they walked by, they said, goodbye, little bird, and a car drove by and ran it over. After eating an egg, you need to crush the shell into small pieces to ensure fertility.
I will not tell stories about Shadim or Lilith around pregnant women or small children. Lilith is the bane of pregnant women and small children. You're not supposed to pour water from a pitcher backhand over your wrist, because that's how the Chevra Kadisha pours the water over a corpse.
When there's a family birthday, my dad will always cross out the name on top of the birthday cake before cutting cake slices. This always seemed somewhat Jewish to me, but not specifically so.
My grandmother has a poem that she has my mom say before she goes in for an MRI. We are your sheep, you are our wolves, we are not afraid of us, you will not eat us.
I was raised to never say goodbye, although bye is somehow okay, and I still feel a twinge of fear every time it slips out. Thanks, bye.
Guys, this whole episode just making me think, like, we need our own superstitions. Like,
yes.
Maybe for a live show? Like, what are we going to do? I want to get weird.
Okay, so the superstition begins, like, before a live, like, the Talmudic superstition rendering begins, before a live show, Reb Shloimi ben Shmoikel says, you must, Liel, what must you do?
You must drink, or else the demons come. Bourbon wards off the demons.
Here's what I think you do. So I think it'll be a three-part thing. Well, it'll be additive, right?
It's like you say the first word of the sentence.
Right. So Liel's give us first, you drink. Then.
But I think there should be a specific thing and for a reason.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay. So you.
First, you throw a shot over your left shoulder.
In the green room of the JCC.
In the green room of the JCC.
Sorry,
you say
Marlene Meyerson.
And then, yeah.
You then pour another shot. The three hosts and the producers all pour shots past the shot to the left in a circle, at which point you each down the shot and say, we miss Molly Ye.
Okay, and then when we step onto the stage, you have to step on with your left foot, going on to hitting the stage first.
Yes, yes.
And then we have to walk around the chairs and back sit in them.
This to me is
raising my blood pressure, and I'm getting anxious thinking about, like, okay, I step with my, like, so just be considerate.
We'll be considerate. Well, if you do it wrong, then you just retrace your steps walking backwards into the green room, do another shot, and come back out.
That's right.
And then the demons will say.
Super relaxed.
The demons will say, oh, snap, they mean business, and they will have a great show. We hope you all thought we've had a great show. We think we've had a great show. Thank you for joining us to talk about superstitions. We know we missed a lot. We know we missed your favorite superstition. We know that you have thoughts, hopes, dreams that we'll talk superstitions again. We will. Send us an email at unorthodox@tabletmag.com or call us. Leave those superstitions on the voicemail line, 914-570-4869. That's 914-570-4869. We want to hear about your superstitions. You can also talk to us about your superstitions at our upcoming live shows. We will be in San Diego on January 31st and in Seattle on February 2nd. You can go to the respective websites of the JCCs in those towns to check us out. But before that, we will be at Washington Hebrew Congregation as guests of WHC and the Association of Reformed Jewish Educators. That's January 15th. It's Washington Hebrew Congregation's website that has all the details. It's a free show. So get your tickets now. We'll see you January 15th in Washington, D.C. Unorthodox is brought to you by Tablet Magazine on the web at tabletmag.com. Thank you for being part of our Superstition episode. If you want to communicate with us about it, you can follow us on assorted social media. Instagram is at Unorthodox Podcast, and on Twitter, we're at Unorthodox_pod. If you want to book us for a live show or advertise with us, email producer Josh Cross, that's Cross with a K, jcross@tabletmag.com. And of course, you want to wear and carry Unorthodox, hit up bit.ly/unorthoshirt for shirts, mugs, and onesies. No baby is too young to be a billboard for our podcast. Our show is produced by Josh Cross, Shira Talushkin, and Noah Levinson. Our artwork is by Esther Werdiger. Our editor is Sophia Steiner-Evoy. And we don't say it enough, but Tablet's editor is Alana Newhouse. Our social media intern is Elzar Abrams. Our theme music is by Golem, online at golemrocks.com. Our mailbox theme is by Steve Barton. Rabbinic supervision this week by Rabbi Andrew Shapiro Katz of the Conservative Yeshiva in Jerusalem. And a place that seems haunted to us, but in a good way, is Argo Studios. Shalom, friends.